you say this person's got mercury toxicity, you've treated them with all this expensive dental stuff and some detoxification. And so what have you got to show for it? Well, the thing is, these patients get well again in many, many cases, and they stay well.
Dr. Damian Wojcik is an integrative health doctor, a metal toxicology expert with decades of experience treating mercury toxic patients, and a fellow Kiwi. We had a chat about mercury poisoning and how germs and mental illness have been used as a scapegoat to cover up mercury toxic symptoms. Welcome, Damian, to our new studio in the beautiful North Canterbury region. It is so exciting to have you as our first guest on the show. Now tell me, I wanted to know a little bit about your background and how you became interested in mercury toxicity.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to share with you, Sam. I'm a GP, living and working in Whangarei, and I've been there since 1992 and been a GP since 94. In the early days I did obstetrics and delivered several hundred babies. I've been a police doctor, and then I got into nutrition and environmental medicine and metal toxicology. And I guess the reason I got into mercury was a little bit of personal experience of mercury toxicity. In my early days as a GP, I found my memory was failing, and it was a very frightening sort of experience personally, and who do you go to talk to about it when you're starting practice? And fortunately, I was able to consult with Dr. Mike Godfrey in Tauranga, who was able to help me to diagnose and to treat me. And I guess as a result of that personal experience, I became very interested in toxic metals as a potential cause of chronic ill health, the kind of problems that I was seeing in my general practice.
What are the symptoms of mercury poisoning?
Well, the common symptoms are cognitive, with memory impairment, difficulty thinking clearly, mood disturbance with perhaps despondency, sometimes depression. A tremor can be a feature of mercury. Probably the most common would be a debilitating fatigue. And so as good GPs, we would look for anemia and hypothyroidism and perhaps do a standard panel of tests. All your tests are normal, but then they'd say, but I'm still fatigued. And so basically my curiosity to try and find the underlying causes for patients that were presenting was what really got me interested in mercury, plus my own personal experience. And then as more patients came, it became apparent that the spectrum of symptoms was extremely wide, and mercury toxic patients could present with autoimmune problems. Mercury is known to mimic, to amplify or cause many of the known neurological syndromes, Alzheimer's dementia, and I'll come back to that subsequently and a bit later, motor neurone disease, particularly amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Parkinson's disease and so on. Mercury causing extreme oxidative stress can make any of these conditions worse and can sometimes contribute and cause them. I guess in the early days I became aware that patients that had severe depression that didn't respond to antidepressants would turn out to have metal toxicity, and often with mercury. Also, patients would present with poor immunity. They present with intestinal symptoms, with was flora dysbiosis or imbalance of the flora populations. Commonly they'd be gluten and dairy intolerant. Many of the symptoms, of course, with mercury are common to other syndromes and conditions, and that's why unless you actually are looking for it, you might not actually think of it. When I started to study mercury a little bit more deeply, I found that there was a very long history of mercury toxicity in terms of the writings and the classic cases. And if you go back to modern day Yugoslavia and Lyria, they had the mercury mines in 4th century AD. And the workers there basically had to extract the mercury, and they just heat the cinnabar, mercury sulfide, a black substance, and these little tubes, and out would roll this liquid elemental mercury. It's pretty obvious that a lot of these workers would start to get sick, and they did. And so the earliest descriptions of mercury poisoning were nasal catarrh, so lots of, you know, mucus and catarrh. And then they would become very irritable and quarrelsome, erythismus, you know, mercurialis. And then the final stage of mercury poisoning was basically they became comatose, you know. And so even back in those times, they recognised that mercury could cause, you know, toxic symptoms. And then if you kind of fast forward to felt hat makers, they used mercury nitrate to stiffen the felts, and then they would heat the felt and drive off the, you know, the mercuric, and then you'd be left with a nice shape of the hat. And of course, you know, they got very kind of ill themselves, and hence, you know, as mad as a hatter is the description we know. Shy, quarrelsome, you know, argumentative, forgetful, sleepy. The wonderful description of the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, I think, probably is derived from that description. Well, that was basically mercury toxicity. And then if you come a little bit further forward to the 1926, there was a very famous German professor, Alfred Stock, who did a lot of scientific work with mercury in his laboratory. And there was a lot of mercury spilled on the benches and the floor. And of course, in winter, it was hot, it was cold rather, so they'd heat the place up and shut all the windows, and they'd get very sick. And he, you know, very accurately described his symptoms. And he had chronic sinus problems and headaches and irritability and so on. So he wrote a treatise on the dangers of mercury. Of course, some of our famous scientists, you know, Newton in 1692-93 did a lot of his alchemy experiments where he had the, you know, injudicious habit of dipping his finger in the things that he was testing and tasting it, and you know, he had quite a bit of mercury, and during those times he was very forgetful, had headaches, and, you know, became depressed and was very paranoid and so on. And you know, hair samples from Newton were very high in mercury, 197 parts per million was extremely high. So, you know, even the famous and brilliant can make mistakes and not be aware of what they're doing. And then if you come to the Minamata Bay disaster in 1940s to 1953 or thereabouts, the factory was making vinyl chloride, and one of the, you know, processes involved a mercury catalyst, and this was being released into the water of the bay, and that was contaminating the fish, and the local fisher people were becoming very toxic with this. They were also feeding the contaminated fish to their cats, and the cats were becoming very unwell and screaming at night, very unwell, jumping into the sea and drowning. And then suddenly this whole village was engulfed by these profoundly strange symptoms. And these poor fishermen and women and their children, they didn't know what was going on, and they were ostracized. They thought it was something spiritual. They had no idea what it was. And so they didn't want to go near them in case they got it, you know. And so these poor people with mercury toxicity were shunned and isolated. And but it took some time to actually find the cause, as you know, methyl mercury toxicity. And I had a whole constellation of symptoms, including, you know, a tremor. There were congenital cases with cerebral palsy. There was some, you know, the mental symptoms and dementia and so on, and extreme fatigue, and many of them were bedridden before they died. And then in 1972, there was the Iraqi grain disasters, where some very enterprising peasants stole a few train loads of grain, which was meant for sowing in the soil, but had been treated with a mercury, you know, fungicide. And so they became very, very sick. Many hundreds died. And at that time, the Iraqis appealed to anyone in the world for assistance. And the Russians had DMSA, dimercaptosuccinic acid. And they said, well, here is a treatment where you can chelate the mercury.
What are the tests used to detect mercury toxicity?
If you suspect someone has mercury toxicity, you use good medical paradigm. You take a history, you get the symptoms, you do an examination, and I can come back to that in a moment if you like. But testing is one of several methods. Traditionally, doctors will do a blood mercury test. But in my experience, probably of over 500 blood mercury tests, it's not a very helpful test, because unless the mercury exposure has been recent, a few weeks to perhaps a couple of months or less, you won't find the mercury in the blood, because it goes through the blood and it goes out into the tissues. It's a lipophilic element. It goes to fat and to brain tissue and to nerve tissue and to deeper tissue stores. While in my 25 years or so of testing people, the mercury toxic, a group of patients will have a blood test of about 13 nanomoles per litre, and the healthy controls about 9 or 10. There's a statistical significance between the means for those two populations. In practice, it's not a very good test for discriminating those who have got, you know, mercury toxicity and those who don't. Non-toxic threshold is quoted as less than 50, so you're going to miss, you know, 99% of any of the mercury toxic patients anyway. So then you can say, well, okay, do you do a hair test? And a hair test has been used for, you know, forensic cases, and for the Dartmouth University professor who became very, very, you know, sick with mercury exposure from dimethyl mercury. But in most cases, the hair test is not very good for testing for mercury, other than for checking for mercury from fish particularly, because the hair tends to measure the methyl mercury, which is the organic mercury, and that tends to go to the hair, whereas the elemental mercury from environmental contamination and amalgam fillings, for example, that's elemental and it goes less to the hair. So you'll miss that in the hair if you're dealing with elemental mercury as a form of testing. So the test that I prefer to use is what we call a provocation urine test, where you're using a chelating drug, which is taken either orally or given as a small test dose intravenously. It circulates through the tissue, the extracellular fluids, and it binds to the toxic metals, of which mercury is one of 15 commonly tested, and it's then flushed out the urine. So now when you collect the urine for 6 hours afterwards and have that sample analysed by mass spectrometry, you can use that as a measure of deeper tissue stores. In that 6-hour test, healthy controls might have a test result of about 10 or 11 micrograms per gram of creatinine. And the mean for my mercury toxic patients is around 35, and a level that I've often used from international consensus is around 16 micrograms of mercury per gram of creatinine. And so that test is the one that I use.
Is that the DMSA test?
Correct. So DMSA is an oral form of a chelating drug. So you give a test dose of that, say 1,000 milligrams or 1 gram of DMSA, and then you do the 6-hour urine collection, or you do a DMPS urine challenge with 3 milligrams per kilogram of DMPS. And then you collect the urine and measure it. The propagation test is probably helpful in my view, because you don't have to do tissue biopsy, and I haven't had any patients volunteer for that test. But you know, strange to say, some of our regulatory authorities in New Zealand demand proof of tissue pathology or tissue damage, and so I generally reply, well, how, pray tell, do I determine tissue damage in a living patient? So how the heck do you take a sample of brain to measure the mercury to prove tissue damage? So the provocation test is way more helpful in this situation. Physical examination is looking for the signs are very important. Sometimes they're very subtle, just with tongue tremor or very fine tremor of the fingers, for example. Some of my worst mercury toxic patients have got extreme balance problems. And usually my staff have made the diagnosis before I have, because they see the patient sort of weaving their way down the hallway, bumping into the walls as they come down to my room.
What treatments, Damien, are used for mercury toxicity?
The treatments that I have used are basically a combination of chelating or detoxification drugs. The commonest prescription ones are DMSA capsules, which I have a 3-month protocol, either 1 week on and 1 week off, including minerals on the off week, and other non-specific chelating agents like modified citrus pectin or chlorella, which helps the process. Bear in mind that when you chelate out mercury and lead and other toxic metals, you do also remove some of the beneficial minerals like zinc, and you must replace those as part of your protocol. So the DMSA is one protocol. I use that for both adults and children. The other is a DMPS, dimercaptopropane sulfonate, given as an infusion, and it can be given, you know, 2 to 4 weeks apart for several infusions, and that again binds very strongly. So most hospitals in Europe would have a stock of a DMPS to administer to acutely ill mercury toxic patients. Bear in mind that most of the presentations that we have in general practice are chronic toxicity, taking several months to several years sometimes to evolve. And you know, the fatigue might initially be mistaken for the aging process.
In your experience in practice, were the patients misdiagnosed quite a few times?
Let me give you a case, for example, perhaps a couple of cases. In my early days, I had a woman who was extremely unwell with manic depressive illness, and both my GP colleagues wanted to commit her. Her family just, you know, didn't really want to do that, but they said, well, can I give an opinion? So I said, sure, I'd be happy to see her. So I went out to get my patient. I couldn't find her anywhere. I went back to the tea room, and there was my patient sitting in a chair, facing a wall, rocking backwards and forwards, clutching a teddy bear and talking complete nonsense. So I took her down to my room and did an examination, and she had a lot of unrelated, seemingly, laboratory tests and symptoms. She certainly had tremor of the fingers and tongue. She had mercury fillings in her mouth. She had an increase in protein being passed in the urine. She had chronic low back pain. And she did actually volunteer later that she had extreme road rage, so she had to disconnect her horn because it was, you know, she was using it all the time, and motorists were getting angry and threatening to, you know, to assault her, so she had to disconnect her car horn. Anyway, testing showed very high levels of mercury, so we treated her, and 8 months later she was incredibly sane, beautiful, back to work again. I had another patient who became incredibly sick with fatigue, and then became very weak, and then couldn't walk, ended up in hospital for investigations, and all the tests were sort of negative, and after a week's of intensive investigations, she was sent home with a diagnosis of pervasive refusal syndrome. Anyway, her GP rang me up and said, would I be prepared to see this young lady? Because she was dying, and she says, I wouldn't know what to put on the death certificate. She had a very, very high blood level, one of the few where the blood had actually been helpful in this situation. And it turned out that she'd been exposed to a broken fluorescent light tube, which had broken on the carpet in the room where she was working and studying, and became very, very profoundly unwell. She couldn't chew properly. She couldn't tend to showering and couldn't walk. Totally dependent on her family for everything. She just said yes, 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 no, 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 and had no deep tendon reflexes, had a tachycardia but no fever. And it took me nearly 3 years to treat her with DMSA and intravenous vitamin C and other nutrients, glutathione included. Well, today, I might say.
You've mentioned before to me that when a patient is treated for mercury toxicity with DMSA or what have you for that 3 month period, that it takes them longer to recover than the 3 months. Could you explain a little bit more about this?
It takes probably 6 to 9 months on average for the patients to start to recover reasonably good health after the conclusion of the detoxification process. And I guess that makes sense because you're removing as much of you as you can of the mercury, but it takes time for many of the enzyme systems to start to recover and to do repair and to reverse the metabolic processes that mercury sets in place. If you don't treat the patients when they have mercury toxicity, then they come back 10 years later and they're still sick. And I've had patients that have left the area and come back and said, well, you know, so what's wrong with me? And I said, well, actually, I told you a few years ago, and here's the test results, and now, you know, you've got to do something about it.
Where does mercury come from?
There are many sources of environmental contamination. Broken fluorescent light tubes, for example, broken energy saver bulbs. I remember a policeman who got very sick with mercury, and he was eating a tin of tuna every day to bulk up his muscles, and after 2 years he became very sick with methylmercury poisoning.
Damien, can we specifically talk about fish and mercury? Because I'm really interested in this topic.
Well, basically our fish concentrate the mercury that's present as a contamination, environmental contamination, in the seawater. So starting with the smaller shrimps, it goes up to the smaller fish, the bigger fish, then the predator fish, and so on. So the further you go up the food chain in the sea, you get more mercury. So the fishes that are eating other fish, the tuna, shark, marlin, swordfish, have more levels of mercury. And so that becomes particularly relevant for pregnant women, in my opinion. If you're eating too much tuna or predator fish, then you're going to transfer the mercury across the placenta into the unborn child. So fish is definitely a potential source of mercury.
Do you eat fish?
I do. Yes, I have fish. I enjoy fish. But I must say I tend to be a little bit less keen to eat large marlin steaks now. But I need to tell you that probably the largest source of mercury exposure comes from our mercury amalgam fillings in the mouth. And it's always puzzled me why you would use the third most toxic element in the planet and plonk it into fillings 2 centimetres away from your brain.
Why is mercury used in amalgam fillings?
It's very easy to insert. You just grind off the high point, so you don't have to be too particular with the shaping of it, because you grind it off. But basically it releases mercury. I've shown this and measured this. I received a grant from the Northland Medical Research Foundation to purchase a Jerome Mercury vapor analyzer. And so I measured the mercury levels in 850 patients or so with and without mercury fillings. And it's very clear that you get increasing amounts of mercury. In fact, it's an exponentially increasing level of mercury vapor is produced as the number of mercury surfaces goes up. A typical range is between 0 and 20 micrograms of mercury per cubic meter, and that's basically the measure that you get. 0.3 is the level where it's the lowest observed effect level for mercury. Below that, it's said that you get very few of any symptoms. So theoretically, you could be exposed to 0.3 micrograms per cubic meter for 24/7 for your life and have no symptoms. A level of 25 is the level at which a worker must not be exposed above 25. But the levels that I was measuring were 0 to 20, sometimes up to 80 micrograms per cubic meter in the mouth. Moreover, when I warmed the mouth up with a glass of hot water, or semi-hot water, and then measured the mercury again 45 seconds to 60 seconds later, you got a mean increase of 60% higher level of mercury released just by warming the fillings up. The amount of mercury released increases when you chew, when you grind, when you brush your teeth, when you chew chewing gum, hot drinks I've mentioned. And also there's a type of mercury filling, a very shiny, bright mercury fillings are copper amalgams, and they release mercury up to, assessed 50 times higher. So they're nice polished ones, often put into young women, because they look nice and they have a nice polish, but they release a lot more mercury.
Damien, when the mercury toxicity happened to you, why do you think there was a delay between your amalgam fillings being put in and the onset of your symptoms?
That's a good question, Sam. And the mercury was released 24/7. The levels build up in the tissues. And we have metabolic ways of adapting and soaking up some of the mercury. If you have enough selenium, then you bind to the mercury and you have less toxicity. So patients with low selenium have earlier and more toxicity, for example. We have a protein called metallothionine within cells. It's got a large number of cysteine amino acids in this particular protein, and it binds to metals, and so that the metallothionine is able to bind the toxic metals, particularly lead, mercury and cadmium. And it displaces the zinc and the copper, so we've got another way of binding. And I guess it takes time often for the symptoms to manifest. It also depends a little bit on the age of presentation. Younger children and young adults who have mercury tend to have the excitatory symptoms. They tend to be more kind of, keyed up and anxious and go-go and hyperactive and so on. Whereas as the mercury builds up for older patients that present, it's usually more the depressive, loss of social skills, loss of memory, loss of motivation, kind of social withdrawal and so on. Extreme fatigue, just, can't play sport, can't, participate and so on. So, the age of presentation is important, but you also need to know that there's a mercury toxicity is primarily a disease in women. There's a 2-to-1 ratio of women to men, at least in my series of just under 1,400 patients. There's about 850 or so women to 430, 425 men. Women tend to present a little bit earlier. In their 45 to 50, whereas men tend to present as a mean peak presentation around 50 to 55. we know that estrogen is protective against mercury toxicity. So it's probably as women go through the perimenopause that they lose that protective effect and that the mercury becomes more sort of prominent. So mercury builds up, and standard toxicology would say that as the level builds up, it gets to a threshold, and then bingo, you get disease. But there is the problem of silent toxicity, and we've come to know about this since the 1970s, when we have some extremely elegant biochemistry and assay methods for looking at microscopic and cellular toxicity, and it's clear that you get these adverse changes long before you get a clinical symptoms or syndrome that you'd recognize as a clinician.
What are some of the animal experiments that they've done with mercury?
Animals don't generally develop autoimmune conditions where your immune system is attacking your own healthy cells. Okay, so in the mammalian models, there's no model for autoimmunity, but the way you provoke autoimmunity in your rabbits and rats is you expose them to mercury, inject them with mercury, and then a large percentage will develop antibodies directed against their own healthy joint tissue and so on. And you then take those animals and send them off to the university and the medical school for testing, basically. That's how you create autoimmune problems. So if you want to stabilize someone's, incurable autoimmune condition, then you look for mercury, and if it's present in testing and symptoms and so on, then you treat it, and you've got a much better chance of stabilizing their autoimmune condition and having longer periods of remission and less serious evolution of their autoimmune condition.
Because clearly this must have ramifications for the earlier vaccines that contained thimerosal. Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, that's right. The preservatives they used with thimerosal was one of the obvious sources of mercury. I should explain that the standard toxicology model, where you just build the dose up with time and then eventually you get sick, is one toxicological explanation of what happens. But there are other things that happen as well, and one of them is that you can develop a type 4 metal allergy, where when your body is exposed to a metal like nickel or thimerosal or aluminium or cadmium, your immune-competent cells, the lymphocytes, the T lymphocytes, recognize that metal and become sensitized to it, and then on re-exposure you develop tremendous reaction, and you get a little bit like someone who's got a peanut allergy and they have peanuts and they get a swollen lips and tongue and they get very sick and sometimes get an anaphylactic reaction. Well, you can have a similar reaction with cytokine inflammatory protein release when you're exposed to the metals. And so sometimes the toxicology of a person's presentation is that they have precisely that, a type 4 metal allergy. And on re-exposure to that metal, then you get, the symptoms keep, reoccurring with a cytokine storm. And if you've got a metal implant in you, like a mercury amalgam filling, for example, like a titanium, implant with nickel in it that you're sensitive to, then the only way of helping that patient is to remove the source of the metal, to remove the implant, to remove the mercury amalgam filling.
What do you advise people? Should they get their amalgam fillings removed?
Well, that's a good question. I guess The best thing is to avoid putting them in the first place.
Mm.
And up till 1976, dental nurses were advised to do preventive endotomies, where basically you drilled out healthy enamel, put in a mercury filling so that you wouldn't get food stuck down the little central, you know, valley, the little crevicle. And so lots of people, myself included, had virtually all our molars and premolar teeth drilled and filled, and we had a heck of a lot of mercury amalgam that we probably didn't need. Post 1976, they were advised, well, just drill carious teeth only. So overnight, the number of mercury fillings fell by 50%. It's a case-by-case basis. Certainly, if you've got clinical mercury toxicity, you've got to go through standard toxicology advice where you remove the source of exposure, you support the person's metabolism, and then you basically remove residual as best you can. And if you do that, then you get tremendously gratifying results in terms of resolution of long-standing fatigue, lessening of depression, reversal of memory loss, better balance, stabilizing of the MS, for example.
Do you see MS patients come to you with mercury?
I do. One of the remarkable papers that really got me thinking was a paper published by a somewhat controversial Hal Huggins, where they had four patients that had MS, proven MS, and what they did is they took a lumbar puncture and stored it for the four patients, then replaced all their amalgam mercury fillings, plus any toxic or devitalized teeth were dealt with. So if there was root canal toxicity, that was dealt with as well. And 24 to 36 hours, they had a second lumbar puncture performed. And all eight samples were coded and sent blinded for protein analysis of the cerebrospinal fluid. And what they found was that all of the four patients had very abnormal black bands of the, you know, the abnormal proteins, which what you get, you know, very high levels of abnormal proteins in the CSF and MS patients. But following the procedure, all four had a complete disappearance of those abnormal proteins, and what was left was a single normal albumin band in the center. And that was just a mind-blowing paper that I read early on in the piece. And it seems to my mind that definitely mercury is somehow contributing to the amplification or the cause or the continuation of the MS. In terms of everybody going out and having the fillings ripped out and changed over to composites, I wouldn't advise that. Because during the drilling process you can release 1600 micrograms of mercury within a 20 to 30 minute drilling period, and the normal exposure is between 3 and 20 per day, so you get a lot of potential mercury exposure and you can get really sick, and I've had people that have got very sick after a drilling session with mercury. So you must have it done safely by a competent dentist who has, you know, at least a rubber dam. So as you lie back in the chair, a little rubber dam, and you push the teeth through, you're drilling so you're not swallowing the gravel. And if you have a mask with medical air or oxygen, then you're not inhaling the mercury so much. And that's as a minimum in terms of trying to make the procedure safe. You must remove every speck of mercury in the socket. You can't leave it and then just, you know, put a white filling over the top of it. You've got to do it properly and so on.
Are there any other natural methods that people can use to detox from mercury?
In my detoxification protocols, I tend to use DMSA and DMPS because they're standard, you know, prescription pharmaceuticals and they work really well. But some people don't want to borrow them, and so you can do it more slowly with modified citrus pectin and chlorella and Selenium, of course, is very useful for mercury. Generally, the naturopathic treatments are very, very slow, and it takes a long time, you know, sometimes years to do the work. But ultimately, you've got to be free of the source. And for most people, if it's mercury toxicity and they've got amalgams in, then you know that they're getting 24/7 exposure. We know this from the early sheep experiments by Vimy and Lorscheider, where they basically put radioactive mercury labelling in the fillings, and then 30 days later did an assessment to see where the mercury had gone, and it had basically gone to every tissue in the body: your eyeball fluid, your brain, spinal cord, heart, thymus, kidneys, liver, certainly across the placenta into the fetus. Within 30 days it was everywhere, and in levels which from other congruent sort of research showed that there was some pathological sort of processes occurring. So you imagine after 30 years how much mercury you've got in the body. It's a lot, and the mercury is released 24/7. The content of the mercury falls 52%, 50%, 45%, 40%, 35%. It's just getting less and less. You say, well, where's the mercury going? Well, 80% is being inhaled, 20% perhaps exhaled and lost, but you're breathing it in 24/7 into your lungs, into your blood, into the tissues, especially the brain tissue.
Over the time that you've been working with patients who have mercury toxicity, has the medical or dental professions been more open-minded to treatments?
Well, that's a good question. Like many areas of medicine, it's been controversial. And well, in 2001, I gave a lecture to the Northland dentists, and they didn't believe a word of what I was saying. And I kind of thought, oh, you know, if I just present my cases and my research, they'd be convinced and start using more composites. Well, and nothing could be further from the truth, and it was the most difficult lecture I'd ever had to give to a hostile audience. So, and I thought, gee, I've got to start doing some research. And so that's when I started to really collect data and then start to publish some of the stuff that I've been researching. I think that quite a few of my medical colleagues would perhaps avoid mercury now, perhaps more for the aesthetic things. You know, why would you put a black filling in a white tooth? So they might tend to go more for the composites. But, you know, gosh, we're still pretty ignorant about mercury amalgam issues. And I gave a presentation to the Parliamentary Select Committee on mercury in support of New Zealand signing the Minamata Bay Treaty to minimise man-made, you know, exposure to mercury. And I well remember the dental advisor saying, well, admitting that basically dentists, yeah, they didn't put it down the drain because they didn't want to kind of pollute the water and pollute the fishes, but it was okay to actually put it in human mouths and have them walk out of the surgery. And you know, the mercury amalgam was exactly the same. When patients have their fillings replaced safely, they have their detoxification, at least 80% of them get significant health benefits. And when I followed up the patients that have been treated, their health score basically returns to levels seen by those people that have never had amalgams, for example, and often 20 years younger, or patients that are really healthy. And those benefits persist for up to 15 years so far as I've been following through those patients. So you might say, well, okay, you know, you say this person's got mercury toxicity, you've treated them with all this expensive dental stuff and some detoxification. And so what have you got to show for it? Well, the thing is, these patients get well again in many, many cases, and they stay well. So I guess what I really come to the conclusion is that mercury is one of the common and commonly overlooked sources of chronic ill health in general practice patients, and that it is possible to reverse that with, you know, with treatment. Interestingly, the European Union basically made mercury amalgam fillings sort of illegal in children up to the age of 15 and pregnant and lactating women. So, you know, you say, well, why might that be? Well, it's because the mercury can potentially cause toxicity in our young people and our pregnant women, and so best to avoid it.
Could you please talk about the mercury research that you've been undertaking and about to publish?
Yes, well, that's right, Sam. I'd love to have a little bit of time to sit down and just research and write and publish. But anyway, I've got an idea for my paper, because I've got about maybe about 4,400 general practice patients in my database, and about just under 1,400 mercury toxic patients. What I've been able to show is that if you look at the number of mercury amalgam surfaces, so if you could imagine a tooth has got an occlusal surface, mesial, distal, buccal and lingual surfaces, and you've got five surfaces, okay, so a tooth that's virtually entirely a mercury restoration has got five surfaces. Another one might just have two surfaces. So basically what I've done with the patients is when they come in, I count the number of surfaces, record that, missing teeth and so on. I'll then do a symptom questionnaire, which involves 110 questions graded 0 to 3. Naught doesn't apply, 3 is severe. And I'll add that score up for each patient, and it involves psychological, neurological, you know, systems, okay? Now, what I've been able to show is that there is a dose response between the number of amalgam surfaces and the total score. So when you graph it, you get a regression line, which is statistically significant. So what I've been able to show is that in a population, there is a very definite dose response between the amalgam, you know, exposure in terms of amounts and the actual symptom score. So that's, I don't believe that's been shown in literature up to this point. So that's very important when you're trying to decide, is something the cause of a condition? You've got to go through a whole lot of epidemiological questions, the Bradford, you know, Hill questions, okay? And is there a reason for it? I mean, we've got a ton of science showing how the toxicity evolves, but you know, if you can show a dose response, that's very important and very helpful. So I've been able to do that. Also, I've been able to show that as the number of amalgam surfaces goes up, the odds ratio of many of the common conditions, chronic fatigue, depression, Alzheimer's, dementia, also goes up.
Anecdotally, I know that I was never taught about mercury toxicity at medical school. Was that the case for you?
Not that I can recall, never. Never at all. And really it wasn't until I had my own sort of experience. And, you know, I've got a lot to thank my teacher and physician who helped me to find out what was wrong with my memory and why it was failing, that was setting me on that path, really. So I've lectured in clinical metal toxicology since 2005. You know, I well recall one doctor who heard my lecture and then went back the next week and diagnosed mercury toxicity in one of the university students who was exposed to mercury vapor from a fan that was connected in series to her, sort of a vacuum pump, and it was in series with a mercury pressure gauge, and the mercury was being sucked out of this machine and blown into her face. And suddenly, after a year, she just, you know, couldn't think. She couldn't get out of bed till 11 o'clock, and you know, thought she was dumb, and she was a PhD candidate, for heaven's sake. And he correctly diagnosed, and we were able to treat her, and you know, get recognition from the university of her her condition. So, you know, maybe some of the things that I've taught will bear fruit, perhaps, and a lot of things that I've told you in this talk, I give over and over to patients every day. But you know, I've come to the conclusion, if you can do a presentation, you might reach a few more than one people, one person at a time. Thank you for your providing your kind of your platform for sharing. So thank you.
You're welcome, Damien. Where can people find out about your work or learn more about mercury toxicity?
Well, I'm kind of still doing integrative medicine and metal toxicology, nutritional environmental medicine at my Northland Environmental Health Clinic in Carmo in Whangarei. I've got a website with a webinar on introductory sort of metal toxicology. But you've given me quite a sort of a nudge to try and get my mercury lecture up on my own website. So I will do that, and that will be a source, and I'll make that lecture available to you, or for anyone who wants to sort of to see that in due course.
Thank you, Damien. That's amazing. It's been so lovely talking to you. Thank you for your time, and I'm really excited to share this with the audience.
Thank you. Thank you for making such a good lecture.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit supportdrsam.com